Okay, today is January 6th, 2015. First interview of 2015. I'm here with Dr. James Boffman from the Journalism Department. My name is Troy Reeves, and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. I know you go by Jim, so Jim, if you wouldn't mind saying your name and spelling your last name.
Sure, it's James L. Right. Yeah, sure. It's James L. Boffman, B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N.
Picking you up perfectly. I'm going to have to speak up a little bit because...
We can move that up too if you want.
Yeah. Make myself at home here. All right, so I'm just scooting the chair up. Get a little closer. All right, so Jim, I gave you some topics.
Yeah.
I know you just got back from New York and the AHA. But
right.
The first question is sort of the broad, why UW-Madison? So let's start with that broad question and go from there.
Well, it was the only job I applied for in early 1979, and I applied for it on a lark, if that's the right word. I was still ABD. I was still trying to finish my dissertation in history at Columbia University. And a secretary in the history department chanced to give me a copy of the search announcement, which had been sent to a select number of history departments because it was a position to teach history of mass communication here. Mm-hmm. The chair of the search committee had arranged for departments like Columbia's to receive the announcement. I had befriended her at a Halloween party that Columbia had at Low Library, I'm pretty sure of this, and we were just chatting, and when she found out what I was doing, what my research area was, unbeknownst to me, she put a copy in my mailbox. I had thought it was my advisor who had done it or somebody else, but it was just this staff person. I don't say just the staff person. She was very good. But Columbia then wasn't a very friendly place. At least my department was sort of, everyone was sort of in a bad mood for the five years I was there. But I always tell my students and friends, be nice to people and you may be surprised, be polite. Because she and I were both standing around at this party with no one to talk to. And so it was. I applied for it, didn't think I'd get it. Got called in for an interview and came out here in early March 1979. And even when I was out here, I didn't think I would get it. And probably had to, and I did have too much to drink at the dinner that was had was I was taken to. But I sort of got hired in spite of myself.
So let's back up to Columbia then.
Yeah.
So what sort of graduate work were you doing? You said you were ABD, so I guess let's work that way and work back.
Sure.
What was your dissertation?
I was in American history. I was working with William Luchtenberg, a historian, senior historian, very well known, and I was writing a dissertation on the Federal Communications Commission under Newton Minow, M-I-N-O-W, and that was, I think, part of the appeal to the search committee that I was working in effect history. You could argue I was working in history of communication, and they were looking for someone to teach the undergraduate course here, and to teach it successfully because the person I was replacing apparently was not very good in the classroom. To the point where one senior colleague told me later they were thinking of killing the course,
oh, wow.
Which had been offered here since the Wilson administration.
Okay. So I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask at least one more thing about Columbia. They have the longest running oral history program in the country, at least at a university, but I'm fairly sure it's in the country. Did you do any work with the oral history program?
I did. Bill Luchtenberg was a big proponent of oral history at a time when not all historians were. And this is in the late 70s. And he actually took his MA seminar, which included me, over to the oral history office. And I got to hear Louis Starr, who helped found the program there and had worked with Nevins, I believe. Give their spiel about oral history. And I still remember that presentation. I also remember that Starr, and I love this, you could do this back in the day, would smoke these giant cigars. And so I got to work with him and Mrs. Mason at the oral history office. I then I did some oral histories for my dissertation of FCC commissioners and people like Frank Stanton of CBS. They were incorporated into the collection at Columbia. I also did at least one interview for the collection of Harlan Cleveland, who had been an undersecretary of state in the Kennedy administration. Got to drive up to the Twin Cities and interview him.
So we're doing this interview in the digital age on a very small, can't be seen because it's an audio recorder, but very small digital recorder. What sort of recording devices were you using back in the mid to late 70s?
We were using portable tape recorders, cassettes, I believe. The original project, as you know, were reel to reel, but those were pretty cumbersome to carry around. So I was using various cassette recorders to conduct those interviews. And I can still remember the training, which was pretty slight, but the training we got, and, you know, where you put the mic and the people after a while forget the mic's on and things like that. So,
was that training done by Starr or was it done by one of the other
people? I can't remember. I think it might have been Mrs. Mason who gave the spiel to us. But again, I can still remember some of Starr's stories about some pretty important oral histories they did, including one with Henry Wallace, FDR's second vice president. And this whole issue of how long do you embargo an oral history? And Starr was pretty amusing about that, saying that oral history subjects tend to be too self-conscious about that and so forth. I remember what Starr saying to us is, Wallace thought he was offending some neighbors or something like that. He didn't want it to be released until sometime after his death.
So you came here to interview in March of 79, offer the job. I assume you were still ABD when you came here in the fall?
Yes, I was. I'd hoped to finish, but that everybody says that. Everybody thinks they're farther ahead than they are.
Mm-hmm. So we'll get back to your dissertation then as we start your sort of path here at UW-Madison. But first off, they said they wanted somebody to teach the intro class.
It's not an intro course, Troy. It's a upper division history of mass communication course. The number is now 560. It's always been 560 since I've been here. And it's an elective course. The student majors don't have to take it, but many do. At the time, it was one of two or three electives that majors, one of which majors had to take.
Okay, my apologies.
No, that's all right.
So my question is, what teaching experience did you have to help prepare you to teach this class?
Well, I had taught summer school at Columbia in 1978, a survey course, U.S. history, which I loved doing. And then in the 78-79 academic year, I was teaching a course that Columbia has long offered, you may be familiar with, called Contemporary Civilization. And it's required, a freshman at Columbia. And it's a great books course. You know, you teach philosophy, beginning with Plato and Aristotle, and maybe ending with Freud. And it was the hardest teaching assignment I ever had because I was too much an American historian, so my intellectual bank was pretty, you know, pretty slight. I mean, my intellectual, my familiarity, I still remember trying to figure out how I was going to teach some of these guys when I'd never read some of them. I mean, I was familiar with some of the authors, of course, John Locke and that sort of thing, but it was the most work I ever encountered. And I think the only reason I was picked to do the course was because my advisor sort of put it, because you know, there was very little support for graduate, my advisor put in a good word for me. There's very little support for graduate students at Columbia. At least there was very little support then. It was sort of embarrassing. I was working part-time for several, I had several part-time writing jobs. which ironically helped me get the job here, because the search committee realized that I had done a lot of deadline writing, reviewing and as you know, and short assignments, that I knew how to write on deadline. And that was, of course, one of the things that journalism education prizes a lot, is being able to write on the spot.
Mm-hmm. So one more thing, maybe just one more thing about Columbia. What were your years there again?
I came in 74, fall of 74, and left in 79. Okay. So I was there for 5 years.
Okay. So you were there at the end of the Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War had just ended when I got there, and then it was an interesting time to be there because Columbia was coming out of the some pretty violent student demonstrations in 68, and there was still a bitter aftertaste there. I mean, I think an alienation between the faculty and students that you could still sense. And a lot of us worked on that. I remember I organized with Alan Brandt, who's now at Harvard, for a bunch of us to take Luckenberg to a Mets game. And that was a kind of gesture that hadn't been, I don't think anybody had tried doing for 10 years. Mm-hmm. But it was a pretty bad time. It was also an incredible time for New York City. The city almost went into bankruptcy. It was a very dysfunctional place at that time. Having just returned from New York, it's so much better than it was. And Columbia is so much better than it was.
Yeah, so that was during the Bronx is burning time
period. Yeah. And, you know, saying that, Troy, I think that there were a lot of faculty like my advisor who would not leave, who remained stubbornly or you know, whether out of habit, loyal to Columbia and would not leave. Although Bill, my advisor, did eventually depart for North Carolina. So I had a lot of good instructors when I was there. It was almost, and a lot of my cohort did quite well, even though we were, one could argue, why are you going there? And, you know, this is a terrible time to be in New York City, and Columbia's in decline, and so on and so forth. And I think that wasn't true. I mean, I think we had a great cohort of, you know, of grad students in history doing some interest. Not me, but most of them were doing really interesting work, mm-hmm. and went on to have really good, you know, pretty good careers, if not very good careers.
So some folks I've interviewed from who were coming onto the job market in this time period talk about how awful it was to get a job.
It was terrible. And one of the things, a professor who named Herman Ossebel had encouraged me and Alan Brandt to think outside what was then outside the box, which was, think about taking a position in a professional school. And I remember Professor Ossebel, who died too young. I mean, I think he died in 76 or 77. But I remember him saying to us, if a business school is looking for an historian, or a med school, which is what Alan did, is looking for an historian. So I had no qualms about applying for a job here. I wasn't going to be a fusspot. And think I had to teach in a history department.
So, you came here in the fall of 79. First off, what was your housing situation like? Where did you end up living?
Well, I had a problem, and I had a cat, and I discovered to my horror that landlords were very fussy about that, even though I in one case actually offered to bribe one. This not being New York, that didn't work. But I wanted to live downtown. I wanted to be able to commute to campus. And at that time, that was crazy because for a couple of reasons. The downtown area, the Isthmus, was populated overwhelmingly by undergraduates who stayed up late and played music and stuff. I had two apartments downtown in succession. The second one was gorgeous. But it was, you know, it was marred by the presence of so many, as I say, undergraduates. I still enjoyed it overall, and my colleagues loved to come down to my parties because they thought they were going to Harlem in the 1920s. So we had some great, great times. But then after I guess would be 7 years, I bought my first house on the Near West Side.
And then, obviously, you taught the upper division course. What was your teaching level beside that?
Normally, my second course, and this remains true most semesters to this day, is a reporting course. And for a long time, I taught our introduction to news writing course, which was then J203. And this was literally, if you plan to be a journalist in the journalism school, but as opposed to practicing public relations or advertising, you had to take that class. And it was, I believe it was capped at 15 students, and it was taught in a lab with typewriters, IBM Selectrix typewriters. And it met for about 2 hours. And we had a series of, you know, I'd say, you know, 15 or 20 minute little talk about how to write a speech story, how to write an obituary. And then they'd write one. And it was, you know, we met, you know, met twice a week, and I had some pretty good students go through that, you know, take that class with me. They were good without much nodding from me, but so that was a course I taught for a long time, and then I sort of began teaching more what were then 300 level, and then became 400 level reporting classes, advanced reporting classes that weren't quite as intense. You didn't feel like you were in a submarine, which was the sensation you had in 203.
Were these courses all taught here in Vilas?
All of them, yeah.
And so, student-wise, you sort of alluded to the fact that you had some good students, but just sort of in general, I mean, these are students that are, like the students at Columbia now, out of sort of the Vietnam era. In general, how would you characterize, you know, the students of your early years of the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah. The ones who were at the Cardinal had a little bit of a chip on their shoulder, but I think I won most of them over because I'm a little bit of a politician with students. That is to say, I work at it, you know, get them to trust me. But most students I had were from Wisconsin and Minnesota, pretty shy. You know, you had to work at them to get them, which is not a great quality to have if you want to be a journalist, by the way, and you know that. But they were okay. Well, I had some, early 80s, I had some kids who were kind of, I think, too passive, too indifferent. But what happened, and I may be anticipating your next question, is we began to raise the admission standards in the school. So the kids we were getting in the late 80s and 90s were more motivated and worked harder. And that accelerated in the aughts and now to in terms of quality, in terms of diligence and all of that of the students.
So you talk about being sort of a politician in terms of doing the work to get the students to like you, trust you. How difficult was it in those early years, both as a young professor, but also with these students, as you say, a lot of them have this sort of Midwest, nice, reserved attitude.
Well, I had really some really good teachers in terms of a class like 203 or some of those classes. I went to a working class high school in Warren, Ohio, and when I thought back on it, I didn't always like them. I had a lot of teachers who were coaches. Football coaches and stuff like that. As it turned out, some of them were really good teachers, and they carried this kind of blue collar, which I'm not. I mean, I have a family of bankers and engineers, for Christ's sakes. But and I hope the Christ's sakes is in the transcript. But you know, I'm a family of bankers and engineers. But my hometown was pretty. It was, I don't want to say it was egalitarian, but there was this. I think quality that didn't give much to pretense or to that prize being understood, being clear, even if, you know, some obscenities or profanities had to be mixed in. And I had a Sunday school teacher who was a judge, who was a great teacher. And again, part of it was his ability to communicate effectively and clearly, colloquially sometimes, but. So I'm not sure that I'm not wandering off your question. But
no, not really. I think, at least what I'm hearing and feel free to tell me I'm not hearing it, is that your teachers and your upbringing allowed you to have the type of rapport with these students, regardless of time period, but particularly in these early years.
Well, and what I'm not saying is I was a so-so student in high school and even in college. And maybe I understood. I said this to a student years ago, interviewed me for a story he was doing or she was doing, that I think precisely because I struggled sometimes as a student or didn't put as much into my class as I should have, that I think it made me a better teacher. And I've had a friend of mine say that, make that same confession to me, who's a very successful teacher on this campus, that sometimes the Phi Beta Kappas aren't the best teachers because learning came so easy to them. And they say, you know, the old saying in baseball, Troy, that great players don't make great managers. Mm-hmm. And so maybe I was a guy on the bench. I was the Bob Uecker. But I think that made me a better teacher. I also know this in my history class, my lecture courses, where models there were some of my best college and grad school professors. That if I assigned a book in my history of mass comm class, I wanted them to understand it. I had professors in college and grad school, Troy, who would assign a book and never talk about it in class. And I realized in retrospect that was very indulgent. I couldn't do that here at the State University. And these kids would have killed me if I, you know, if I assigned Ronald Steele's biography of Walter Lippmann, and they did try to kill me when I did that. But not sit down and go through it with them. You know, here's what you need to learn. And that was something I picked up intuitively. I figured out, and part of it too was these kids are bright, but they're not history majors, most of them. And they want it. It's incumbent on me to explain. Here's what you need to know. Here's what's important about blank.
So let's come back to the it's history of communication. Is that the
history of mass communication?
History of mass communication. So when you came here, and obviously that class had existed, you said, for, you know, decades and
it
decades.
May have been 1914 when it was first offered. My students think I was a TA at that time.
So did they give you a blueprint? Was it up to you to create it, you know, your version of it? How did that work?
Essentially, I had control over what was assigned, and the literature, the number of assignable texts, articles, and books at that moment was pretty small. It was not a substantial literature. There was a textbook that I thought was god-awful that I used for a year or two, and then I dropped it. Instead, I moved to a model, more of a history department model, and we got cross-listed in history. It's still cross-listed in history, which I'm very proud of, although that was not much of a struggle. But we went to a model where instead of assigning a textbook, I would assign, say, 6 or 7 books an article starting with the revolution or the pre-revolutionary period and ending now with the Vietnam War in the press.
Okay.
And they had to read, and they also had to read stuff on the history of public relations and the history of advertising, because that's a big part of our undergraduate population, advertising and PR.
Was that something that you did from the beginning, or is that something that you learned?
Gradually did as that literature emerged. There really wasn't a good assignable text in advertising history until the mid-80s. Before then, it was just pretty grim. There might be a series of articles you could use, but very few serious scholars, in my view, were doing serious work in journalism, advertising, PR history. I mean, you could put us all in this office and still have room for the offensive line of the Wisconsin Badgers. And this is a small office.
Mm-hmm. So that was early on?
The early, mid-80s. And then suddenly it mushrooms. And you begin to see some good work being done, in some cases by historians in journalism schools. In most cases, snob, it was being done by people in history or political science. A book I've long used, maybe I've been using it for too long, is by Daniel Hallin, H-A-L-L-I-N, The Uncensored War, which was put out in paperback, and it's a very provocative book about the news media in Vietnam, and that's intended to get the students to think, rethink maybe assumptions their parents told or the History Channel tells them about the role of the press. And that's part of my job, I think, as a teacher, is to challenge them to not to accept, because this is, a larger mission for me, not accept the heroic interpretation of journalism. It's not that journalists are anti-heroes or you know, whatever. But when I came here, it coincided with the publication of a book by David Haberstam, The Powers That Be, which sort of painted reporters as all-knowing, this is in the post-war era, as all-knowing and wise and shrewd. And I thought that was just nonsense. It's not that reporters don't have a tough job and haven't done it well at times, but they're not saints and they're not perfect. And the other most important thing is the reporters are as guilty as anyone of accepting whatever the conventional wisdom is at the moment. And that was something Haberstam couldn't quite come to terms with in his book. I think later in his life he hinted at it. But I wanted students to enter journalism, to be journalists, but I wanted them to do it with some humility, with some sense, maybe I don't want to make the mistake that was made 50 years ago or in the situation, you know. Without deflating them, because that's the other problem with a course like that. If you're not careful, if you do your job too well, and I think this may be true with some courses we offer, students end up wondering, why in the world would I want to enter this field? I always like the story I love. I don't know if you're a Marx Brothers fan, but I tell this to students. There's a line where Harpo is being lectured by a sort of an old fusspot. He says, "Young man, someday you'll learn you can't light a candle at both ends." And then Harpo proceeds to pull out a candle that's lit at both ends. That's what I want the students to be thinking about. Mm-hmm. Is it is possible to become a journalist or a PR practitioner and to be proud of that, to do good work, but to also to be mindful that it's not a perfect profession, that all callings have their failings, except maybe oral historians.
So one more thing about the early years of the class.
Yes.
And maybe this isn't necessarily early years, but you said...
Back in the early years.
Eventually you added Vietnam. The course now ends with the Vietnam War.
Right,
when did
right.
you decide that Vietnam became historical and not...
Oh, I felt from the get-go it was, but, and I'll be very candid with you, my ability to teach Vietnam was based on the availability of a text I could assign. I might lecture on it. I lecture a little bit on Watergate, but I don't use a text. And it has to be to me to be a serious academic text. I'm not going to assign nonsense. I don't necessarily agree with the text, if you know what I mean, as an historian yourself. In fact, students have been confused sometimes because they'll see me in class having assigned a book and then arguing against it. And they,
and that's part of maybe teaching in general, and maybe your teaching style is that, or I assume it is anyway, is that, you know, again, the text doesn't have to be gospel.
Yeah. And kids don't always get that. And again, it took me a while to figure that out. Let me give you an example that, and you're too young to remember this, but there was a time in U.S. history when I think every course I took on the Civil War in antebellum America assigned Stanley Elkin's book Slavery, which was published in the late 50s, extremely controversial. I never met a teacher who liked it. They always lectured against it. And so I got it. I understood that that might be done, that was a way to learn.
I want to ask a few more questions.
Sure.
About, you know, your first early-ish years on campus.
Yeah.
So first off, you came here ABD. Can you talk about the process of finishing a dissertation while trying to also be a full-time, I'm assuming you came in as an instructor and not necessarily...
Correct,
but
correct.
Still a full-time instructor.
Right, right. I was teaching two courses, actually it was a two and a quarter, I think. It two courses a semester, and then every fourth semester I was teaching a third course, something that we were able to negotiate out of in the early 90s. But it was horrendous. I think back on it now, Troy, and I don't understand how I did it, but I didn't have much of a social life. I remember that my colleague Bill Hackton offered to take me to a football game, and I said I couldn't go, and he sort of gave me this quizzical look because he knew I affected to be a sports fan, and I said, I got to work on my dissertation. And so now that's a lecture I give my dissertators if they go ABD. I said, just be prepared to make sacrifices. And so it was a lot of that. And then my advisor was not happy with the drafts I was sending him, which was traumatic. In retrospect, I understand what the issue was. And he was right. And now that I've been in the hilarious irony, if that's such a thing, where I've been directing students ABD and they've been doing, I've had the same, I've now sort of role reversal where I'm getting these dissertation chapters and I'm going, this is not going to work. I don't care when your contract expires. This is not satisfying.
Mm-hmm. And we might get, I'm assuming we'll get to that as we sort of move on in your career. So when did you finish?
I defended in the spring of 81, okay. Which was, I was just about reaching my shelf life or expiration date. If I had to put the defense path much farther, I think I was going to be in the first President Bush would say deep doo-doo. If I had.
Did that trigger your employment here? Did that trigger a move from instructor to professor?
Assistant professor.
And was that a straight, I mean, did there have to be any, besides the paperwork that always has to be done, but was there any sort of anything besides that to make that?
Well, my girlfriend had a party for me. That was nice. And it was a surprise party. I walked into my apartment and all my colleagues were in there, you know, drinking my booze, my beer. No, it was pro forma. I was told this from the beginning, that as soon as you defended, the paperwork would be submitted. The one thing I was told, and this is not necessarily true now, Troy, but a lot of this is negotiable, is that those 2 years, two academic years, were on my tenure clock. So even though I was ABD, you know, I was going to be up for tenure in 85, whether I was ready or not, you know. Today, and now I'm going to sound like the radio comedians Bob and Ray, you know, all of this gets negotiated with junior faculty. So, there are all kinds of extensions and things.
So let's, since you brought it up, let's talk about the path to tenure then. I don't know if there's a way to describe everybody's path to tenure, I think is a little different, but maybe talk a little bit about your path to finally getting tenure.
My colleagues were, at least outwardly, very supportive of me, but I did have, and again, it's like a, you know, it was, I had my share of rough moments. The main one being, Troy, was that getting my dissertation published as a book, which took longer than I'd anticipated. In fact, this is how close I cut it. I got it, the galleys were available when my tenure package was put together, my first book. I'd also gotten an article published that was pretty good and about early television in the 1950s, and a few other things. But my CV was pretty thin. I mean, it was... And I was lucky. I mean, my colleagues stood by me, and I think if I'd been in another department, I might be selling insurance now or something. You know? But they stood by me, and the quality that I most appreciated at the time was that although most of my colleagues did not have a training in history, they gave me the benefit of the doubt. I kept telling them, you know, I'd get the dissertation out as a book, and they kept nodding. You know?
I'm just writing this down. So you mentioned colleagues here a couple of times. Are there, or were there, colleagues initially that, specific colleagues that either took you under your wing or you know, served some sort of advice and support role?
Well, there were two or three that stand out. Three, actually, when I think about it. Bill Blankenberg was on the search committee that hired me, and really, he and his wife, Pat, took me under their wing, both socially, and then Bill was, and I, routinely had coffee and lunch every day, it seemed, when I was in my first years here. And Bill was a wonderful teacher and an influence on me in multiple levels in that regard, and also kept me sane. He and Pat even at least once showed up uninvited at my house for dinner. But they were great support. Harold Nelson, Bud Nelson, was the former director of the school. He was also an historian of the news media and was very supportive of me. And Bud's was nearing the end of his time here and was sort of exhausted, had not been able to keep up with the literature. So he thought I was pretty neat, you know, even though I wasn't. I had a lot of enthusiasm he'd lost maybe 20 years earlier, if you know what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Again, very conscientious, very good person. Another source and a very good one was Jack McLeod, who was one of our senior experts in the effects of mass communication. Very broad intelligence. Jack is still around, as was another colleague, Steve Chafee, who was sort of Jack's twin in terms of media effects research. But what was to be admired about both men was that they respected what I did, even though it was very different from what they did. Journalism comm programs in many places suffer from a kind of calculus envy or something, where if you're not doing quantitative research, you're not really a researcher. Steve and Jack didn't feel that way. I mean, they understood that there are multiple ways of studying mass media.
So outside of the journalism, what was it at that time? Was it a department or was it a school?
We've been a school since 1927.
All right, so outside of the J School, who were there other people on campus in those early years that you...
One of my key really support, sources of support and this and that was John Cooper in the history department. John was also a Columbia PhD. We had that in common, although John is somewhat older than I am. I almost said considerably, but we had some that Columbia connection was worth something. Both Ivy Leaguers, which rubbed some people the wrong way, but tough. So we had a lot. He sort of took me under his wing as well, and we had a lot of lunches and dinners together. And he taught early 20th century political history, which was an area that I was originally planning to teach. I mean, my original goal, Troy, was to teach political history of the United States. So he was a close confidant. There were several others in the history department, but I think John stands out.
Okay. And you just spoke to the fact that you have an Ivy League education. Sort of with or without going into specifics, you also sort of alluded to the fact that some people might have seen that as a detriment and not a... how did that, or did it, manifest itself?
I was told, I think by Bill Blankenberg, that when I came out here for my interview, the operating assumption was if they hired me was I would leave the first chance I got because I had gone to Harvard and to Yale. And I was stunned by this because I always thought of myself as a Middle Western boy, Ohioan, whose parents graduated from The Ohio State University, both of whom were thrilled when I got hired here. And I had no real desire to live on the East Coast. But, you know, that's a hard thing. You can deny that, and people aren't really believing you sometimes. The other thing is, and it took me longer to figure this out because I just sort of been thick-headed, was that as soon as you say you went to Harvard, some people just back just goes up. Like, well, you think you're better than I am. Mm-hmm. And to which, but, you know, and you're not saying that. Although we are good in men's basketball now, so, which I never thought I'd live to see.
Mm-hmm. You get a Duke assistant coach that, head coach was an assistant.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not, we're not talking, not, at least not yet, we're not talking college basketball. Not officially on the record, anyway.
Yeah.
So, we've touched on sort of your early teaching, some of your colleagues. What about sort of your post-dissertation research? Once you got that done, did you move into other areas of interest?
I can say, I think the neat thing for me about this appointment, and I felt this way from the get-go, was I was really genuinely interested, as I finished the book on the FCC, on the other side of the book, that is, I was more interested in the television industry than I was in the regulation. And that was a source of tension between me and my advisor, because he wanted me to emphasize the FCC, and I was falling in love with television and as a subject. So this was a perfect appointment for me because I could study the history of broadcasting, the history of journalism, and get tenure, you know, and pay the mortgage. And at that moment, that is the middle late 80s, I'm not sure how many history departments would have encouraged faculty to study that. It was the history itself was changing, as you know, in many ways. And also my focus tended to be institutional, which cultural historians now don't think is, you know, is appropriate or interesting. And I hope they all die young. I think you have to, seriously, people have to do that. If you don't do that, that isn't done and done well, then we're in trouble.
So how does that, once you become more interested in the TV side of the FCC story, how does that start to manifest in terms of your research, your writing?
Well, actually, it was, again, Cooper was a source of encouragement here. I was interested from my teaching in Henry Luce and his magazine empire, Time Inc., and John approached me and said, would you be willing to do a short book on interpretive biography of Luce? And that was my second book. My first was on the FCC. And my second book, which was published really 2 years later, 2.5 years later, was on Henry Luce and his magazines. It was great fun to do, and because I grew up in a family that had all the magazines, and so I was it was easy to do in sort of in that sense. And Luce was a very interesting and complicated and prickly person to write about, but I think I had an interesting argument to make. And that's always the key, as you know, when you're doing a book or an article, well, what's your point? You know, what, you know, and I think I had an argument to make about Luce. So that was my second book. Another colleague in history, you know, Stanley Cutler, came to me, and I got to do a third book for Stanley about, that was a interpretive history of the mass media, which is everything, even rock and roll, since 1941. And that was published by Hopkins in 1992 and went into 3 editions and helped allow me to renovate my kitchen. So.
Do you know why Cutler felt there was a need for this book?
Yes, but I can't remember. Stanley was doing this rather ambitious series for Hopkins, and I'm trying to remember. We had lunch at the old Pisons across the way here, and he had this idea in his head about a book that would talk about the not film so much as but the mass media. And I know what his model for that series was, but he was. And that was a case where, again, there was a sort of an old boys network operating, because Stanley had heard good things about me from Bill, my advisor, I think, and maybe some other people. But it turned out to be, a fairly successful book.
So was that 3 books in your first 10 or so years here? Did those all come
first
out in
the 13, 80s? I guess the 13 years, right. Yeah. 13 years, lucky 13.
Okay. So maybe the last thing for this time, unless it leads to some follow-up questions.
Right.
So we've done teaching and research. What about service to the university?
Well, I was a faculty senator through much of the 80s. I was on the student union, or the whatever it is, committee, union council, which I hated. I was on the Badger Herald board for 5 years, which was interesting at times. And then served on the university press committee, which I really enjoyed. Although that was a limited, you know, tenure. I'd rather hoped it was a peerage, I remarked when my term was ending. In the 90s, I was on the library. I was on the Memorial Libraries Committee and the University Libraries Committee, and chaired both. which I, again, really enjoyed that service. And I'm probably missing something.
So you said you're in the on the Faculty Senate. Did that happen early on?
I think it was fairly early. I may have used that line with my advisor. We've got to do this defense. I was just elected to the Senate. Mm. Mm-hmm. Which I think failed to impress Bill. But
what about the Badger Herald Advisory Committee? What does it mean to advise one of the student newspapers?
The board would meet, I want to say once a month during the school year, and we were apprised. We didn't deal, I think, so much with the editorial content of the newspaper as the fiscal health of the newspaper. I was on the board when it chose to go daily, which was a big deal. It had been a weekly publication.
So, at least in your recollection of it, how was the relationship between the Badger Herald and the Daily Cardinal then in the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, again, this was mostly the early mid 80s. It was pretty, it was pretty tense and antagonistic. Not as antagonistic as it had been, I think, before I arrived. But the rivalry at this point, I think by the middle and late 80s, was more they were trying to scoop each other and sell more ads. It wasn't necessarily ideological. In fact, I think the Herald was moving editorially, trying to move to the center, famously endorsing Michael Dukakis for president in 1988. There's some people who still are in bed over that. I think I was on the Herald board. There were a group of founders of the Herald who were very reactionary, and I say this with a lot of Republican DNA, but these people, to me, were, very reactionary. And they were deposed, I think, when I was on the board. They were asked to leave because they were so conservative. And two or three of these guys, and I can still remember their faces, but the Herald was trying to reinvent itself, become a more centrist voice on campus.
Maybe one more thing about this time period. I'm interested in protest on this campus in general. And I've done some research about protests in the 80s, particularly against some President Reagan's activities. Do you recall?
I don't remember much. I do not. There was some, of course, there were anti-nuclear petitions and so forth, but I don't remember that. What I do remember in the very late 80s is the racial episodes involving the fraternities, and I was teaching that semester, and how heartsick I was, and I'm not saying that, I really mean this, as someone who's, was in high school when that was going on. Racial tensions were exploding in my hometown as elsewhere, and I was heartsick about that, and actually spoke to my lecture class about it. And my TA told me I was one of the few professors to say anything, which I thought was just shameful, because a lot of this, Troy, with kids, and you're a father, is you just have to tell a kid is white and maybe privileged from Brookfield or Mequon, that such and such isn't funny to black people. Mm-hmm. And you need to tell them that. And you need to, my dad was a great believer, although pretty conservative politically, in being respectful of people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds. So I was really heartsick about that, because you keep thinking, well, we're over that, and people are, there's another interview. You're gonna have to come back for me to go on about that, but because I didn't necessarily accept what Chancellor Shalala's solutions were, but either, which put me in an odd place.
Yeah, let's make sure we, as much as you want to touch on that.
Yeah.
The last thing about this time period, again, sort of looking at these first 10 years or so, give or take. Was there ever a time in those early years that either you were tempted or actually looked for employment elsewhere?
I was always keeping my eye out for an appointment in history. But I realized that I would be a fool to you know, to jeopardize my position here and to even, and I think there were moments when I was, my restlessness may have been showing and I had to curb that. I did get a chance to teach in the history department a couple times in the 80s, enjoyed it thoroughly, But I was always keeping my eye up. And frankly, I mean, part of it was, although I think I'm pretty good at it, I never particularly enjoyed teaching reporting classes and thought, why am I teaching, why can't I teach two history courses instead of just one? And mm-hmm. why can't I have a second piece of cake? And, you know, that sort of thing. Okay. But I got over that self-pity. Because what it came down to, Troy, just to be quick for a change, is that I would rather be teaching in journalism at a great university than teaching history at Youngstown State. Mm-hmm.
Did you at this point, last question, did you at this point in these first years, did you start to have graduate students work under you?
Yeah.
All right, so maybe we'll start with that next time.
Sure, well, sure.
I always like to leave the narrator with the last words. Anything on your mind about these again, sort of looking at the first decade or so, late 70s through the 80s, that you want to...
Well, I think what was happening that's worth noting is that our enrollments were ballooning in the early, mid-80s. I mean, they were literally out of control, Troy. And we had to institute enrollment limits, although the college, and we're part of the College of L&S, wasn't happy. But we eventually, in the late 80s, had to institute enrollment limits because we just didn't have the staff to teach everyone who wanted to major in journalism. And that was a critical moment in terms of the quality of students we had. And but we always had a good faculty here. We did have some deadwood when I was first here, and I hope I'm not, you know, taking on that role myself, but we did have some people who needed to retire and did, and we replaced them with some good people. And I'm trying not to sound like the Iraqi information officer about the school, but we had some good, we were always a good department. The question was our ability to serve our majors.
Okay. Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it. So this concludes the first interview with Jim Boffman.